Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight's the night. All eyes will be glued to the television set to see if Tony gets whacked. Jersey gangsters, blood-shrieking violence, intense family drama. We are 3 hours away from the television event of the year, the series finale of The Sopranos. Plus, from Columbine to Virginia Tech, concerned citizens point the finger at movies for inspiring the most heinous acts of crime. A media psychologist will join us to weigh in on this pressing issue. And Tony Farinella joins the geeks for his review of Hostel 2. It's all coming up next. Okay, that opening music did not go well. My name is Jamie, and these are the movie geeks. Let me bring them on real quick. Hey, Jerry and Chris, are you guys there?
Yeah, my name is Jerry. And my name is not Jerry. Good for you.
Oh, we had a big opening planned for you guys, and I pressed the play button twice on the...
It happened to me a couple weeks ago, man.
Yeah, it happens to the best of us.
Yes,
yeah.
It does.
I want to open up the show. I want to tell everybody an exciting announcement. You know, we had so much support for the David Lynch show last week, and we very much appreciate that. And we hope everyone out there enjoyed that. But we have another special two-hour celebration tribute show in 2 weeks, June 24th. And we are celebrating the genius that is Al Pacino. And just stay tuned to the blogs and the bulletin announcements for a list of special guests. But we're all very excited about that one. So June 24th, be on the lookout for it. But speaking of Al Pacino and gangsters and Godfather and that whole thing, tonight's the night. It's The Sopranos. It's the series finale. Are you guys hyped about this?
Yeah.
I am
hyped. I'm a little upset, too. It's like, you know, I can't believe it's over.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I'm very, you know, it's like after tonight, as there are still some good TV shows, but after tonight, it's just back to Palookaville for everyone.
Right. Mm.
But they are kind of coasting into the station with The Sopranos. I mean, I'm a little upset. I'm excited. But at the same time, in the past couple seasons, I think it's been a little, it's like they're running out of ideas. It feels like they're on fumes at this point. So
you think? I used to think that I could go with watching Tony, you know, work all the way up until, like, you know, if he makes it to, like, you know, assisted living or something. You know, I could do that.
Well, you know, I would. I'm not saying I wouldn't watch, but, like, you know, last season left a really bad taste in my mouth personally.
Which now,
left a bad taste in Johnny Cake's mouth too, I'm sure. So.
Yeah. Now, when you mean last season, do you mean the first half, I guess, of this season?
Well, I guess
yeah.
That's what they're classifying it as. Yeah, but
yeah,
okay. Absolutely, it went nowhere.
You know, it did. It started off, no pun intended, with a bang, and then it quickly dwindled after that.
However,
this part of
I'm sorry, man. This part of this current season, I think, is very good.
Yes.
Yeah, and I think it's given some of the most intense kind of dramatic moments that the show's seen in a long time, especially dealing with the family, which is when the show is best, when it deals with the tragedy and the drama that takes place in Tony's domestic life.
Yes,
yeah.
I agree with that. I also agree that I think it was season 5 where Steve Buscemi is a regular, that the show gets all its verve and originality and its core back from the first season. I think by bringing in Frank Vincent as Phil Leotardo, bringing in the Robert Loggia character, bringing in all these different characters, I think he finally realized, hey, I got to stop messing around. And I think it's like it's the beginning of the end in season 5.
Right.
He sets all the players and all the actions in motion.
Right.
Yeah, and it's interesting to note because we're going to discuss what we believe, how we believe The Sopranos should end. It's interesting to note that they did a poll where about 70% of people polled said that they did not think that Tony should die.
Huh.
What do you guys think?
I don't think he should die either. I would be heartbroken if he dies.
I something's got to happen. You know, he's got to... The trajectory of the storyline is taking it so that something's got to happen to Tony so that he can save his family and redeem himself. Either he's got to die or he's got to protect his family by going into the witness protection program. To me, I would be happy from a story point of view with him dying. It would make sense.
Well, for me, You see, I think that everyone doesn't want Tony to die because they just love Gandolfini, and he, absolutely, he's fantastic. He is the show.
He's never going to have a better part.
Yeah, and I don't think he realizes that.
No, he really doesn't.
But for me, I don't think Tony should die because I think that he should live with whatever tragedy befalls his family. And I think a tragedy needs to occur in his family during this episode. And right now, all indicators are pointing to AJ being involved in some way, and some kind of grisly end. Whether
they're focusing on him a lot this season. I mean, more so than so much so that you can't deny that it's coming to a head with him. Something's going on.
Yeah, and I realize it could be a MacGuffin. The whole him, suffering emotional problems and looking up the suicide bombers.
Right, right.
That whole subplot could just be thrown in to preoccupy us. You know?
Yeah, that wouldn't be a first for David Chase. He loves to do that. I think it's actually, if anything, if you're talking about having Tony live, what would be the thing, what would be the most detrimental thing is something happens to Carmella.
That's something that's not often talked about. And in the first episode of this, I'm just going to call it this season, the one that started a couple of months ago.
Right. I hate that they're doing that. Like, why just call it this season, you know?
Exactly. The first episode, remember, even before the fight, she was experiencing some kind of shoulder pain or something.
Right.
And I thought, man, this might be, maybe that's a sign of a heart attack or something. Maybe
that's possible.
Yeah, and I really got to thinking, what would Tony or that family be without Carmella? Because she really is the glue that holds.
No, she's the rock of the family, and as are all mothers, and especially in that type of family, mothers are the rock. They're the real brains and brawn behind any family, and I think that's especially true in this case.
With that in mind, we just want to say Happy Father's Day next week.
Yeah, Happy Father's Day to everyone, yes.
Mothers are the real glue that holds everything together, but Happy Father's Day.
Yes, a father has to die. Yes.
Yeah. No, but I think he's aware of that. I think he's, and I think it's very interesting, last season, Carmella kind of makes this deal where she's finally accepting of what Tony does reluctantly, but she realizes she benefits from it financially.
Yeah. She's
with
kind of selling her soul.
Yeah. I mean, she's like basically, okay, I'm going to use this to my advantage.
Right. Everyone on the show is painfully, morally compromised. You know, there's not an innocent among them except for maybe the children. But yeah, Carmella, the whole drama with her in the, I guess it was probably the first season, it started exploring it, with her counseling her church because she felt like a sinner.
Right.
Stuff that you would not see explored on regular network drama, at least not until Sopranos came along.
Right.
Not in the same way.
No.
It's a very complex kind of drama, and it really is at its best. It's like a movie a week. I can understand why it takes so long to produce these episodes because, I mean, they really do play like an hour-long film every week when they're at their best.
That's a good point. I mean, and then the writing actually is better than most contemporary films over the years.
Oh, goodness, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, as far as looking at individual episodes, last week was, dynamite.
Yes.
It was dynamite episode. You know, you're talking about, like, almost like a movie of the week. Well, that was more that like that than any other show, I think. I think it was the best show they ever had.
Yeah,
one of the best. I think it was definitely the most edge-of-your-seat show. You, Chris, you were in the living room with me when we were watching it.
Right.
We were just jumping up and screaming, and we're like, oh, my God, what's going to, you know. This was like the fan show, I think, where the fans got a taste of what they've been yearning for. But I don't think that the finale is going to play that way. I think the finale might be surprisingly subdued.
That's possible, and he seems to do that with his finales each season. You know, everyone's building up to them, and, you know, usually the next day you're just like, that was okay, what was he trying to do?
Yeah.
I think what was very interesting about last week's, and can we say what happened last week? Are we allowed to talk about that? Are we going to ruin it for people who haven't seen it or are waiting for
We'll just say right now, you know, we're going to talk about it.
We're going to talk about it, folks, and
yeah.
If you were going to give you that, you have the option, I hope you don't turn off. But maybe you might want to check out what the people in your local news are saying. But I think it's when Bobby goes into that hobby shop, I think it's safe to say we all know what's going to happen.
Right.
It's just set up. I mean, he's playing with those trains when Uncle Junior shoots Tony, and it's like this poetic justice, a circle coming back. This is how you're going to meet your end.
You know, I rewatched that episode today, and just from the point of view, the creative point of view, how it was shot, that hit in the train shop.
Yeah.
Very good. They seem to have taken a page from the book of The Godfather. There's always something very, very creative and very different about some of the violence that they portray.
Yes.
Symbolic.
Yeah. And Coppola always said, you know, I abhor violence, but
yes,
when I direct
did.
Violence, I like to do something a little odd, you know,
mm-hmm.
something that makes it the imagery stick in your mind.
And it makes it stand out too.
Yeah.
Well, absolutely. We're going to talk about what our favorite episodes are in just 1 second, but we got a caller from a 416 area code. 416,
hey.
Go right ahead.
Hi, it's Doug, also known as Wolf Shades.
Hey, what's up, man?
How you doing?
It's good to hear you.
Good. How you guys doing? Oh, man.
What do you think of The Sopranos tonight?
I'm looking forward to it. I hope it's not subdued. I hope it's going to be something coming out with a bang. But there seems to be a few sort of little bombs just waiting to go off there. I think AJ, for one, is going to come off in a big way.
Mm-hmm.
He just got beaten up. Well, not beaten up by his father, but his feelings all trampled, for one thing.
Yeah, that's true. He was dragged out of the room, though. I mean, he was dragged out of bed.
Yeah. That's got to hurt. So, you know, it looks like he's going the same way as his dad, too. If you remember, he also had the panic attacks as well, as dad did. So
that's
yeah.
a good point. That's
yeah.
a very good point.
You know, one of the main rumors about the show right now is that AJ will stop a bullet for his father or vice versa. Like, it's going to come down to Tony and AJ in the end.
Do you think Phil will hit the family?
What's that?
Do you think Phil will use the family, go after the like his family members? Do you think Phil is that ruthless? Which I do.
I don't think he has any qualms about it, no.
Okay.
No, nothing holding him back at all.
He doesn't consider them, you know, to be, he said it last week, he doesn't consider them in the same category as, you know, the five families.
Right.
So that I don't think he even has that kind of honor where the Sopranos are concerned.
Yeah, he thinks, and it's been true, and if you watch all like the Godfather films and all the films, that there's always been this, that the New York families look down on New Jersey. They
right.
always have. And that's, Phil represents that and beautifully represents that, you know, that point of view. He really hates them.
Yeah. Our caller, your name is Doug?
Yeah, Doug.
Yeah. What's your favorite episode?
Oh, gosh. Well, you know what? Before last week, I can't remember the best episode, but last week was the best, in my opinion. That was just amazing.
Absolutely.
And the beautifully shot thing with Bobby. I looked at all the little passengers on the, like the little fake passengers, their hands
yeah.
over their mouths, and I thought, wow, that's really well done.
Absolutely. That's exactly what I was talking about. It's just so well shot and so well put together. It's going to be... you know, a lot of shows have been trying to catch up to Sopranos since it debuted.
Right.
And some have caught on. Some are pretty good. But there's just nothing like The Sopranos. And I don't think there ever will be, really. But, Doug, thanks so much for calling
in. Thank you. Thank you very much for calling in.
Good talking to you guys.
Likewise.
Thank you. Okay. Bye-bye. Okay, another caller, 817, area code 817. Go ahead.
Hey, guys, this is John from the Dead Air Show.
Hey, John, what's
up? Hey, John.
Oh, nothing much. How are y'all doing tonight?
We're doing good.
Good deal. Well, you know, you guys are talking about The Sopranos. Of course, I'm super excited about the finale. And, you know, I've heard some theories out here, and I've got a couple, if you don't mind me throwing out.
Sure.
Now, I think the thing with AJ, I think that definitely is something that is gonna come to a head tonight. My opinion, and again, keep in mind, I haven't read any spoiler sites or any of that stuff. I mean, I hate that. I mean, for something like this, I want to be surprised, hopefully, or thrilled.
Mm-hmm.
But my theory is that, number one, Tony's probably going to get out of this whole Phil Leotardo thing. He's probably going to take him out, if not personally. There is a little side story that a lot of people I haven't heard anybody mention, it's like they forgot and they don't realize, is the Middle Eastern men that the FBI had Tony help them out with.
Yeah.
If anybody remembers. Now, to me, it's like that whole thing was set up quite simply on the surface just so they could have an excuse to have the FBI say, hey, by the way, the Leotardo family is planning a hit on you, and I'm giving you that information because you helped us out.
Right.
To me, I think there's going to be more to that, and somehow that's going to make a resurface somehow tonight. I don't know if it's going to be like a terrorist attack is going to happen or something like that. I think maybe the FBI, my theory finally is actually, you know, to make a long story longer, is that the FBI is going to grant Tony immunity and let him know, you know, hey, because you helped us out, we're going to grant you immunity. Maybe move your family, you know, out because, you know, you just took out the Leotardo family. We found out about it, but, you know, because of what you did, we're going to help you out. And at the end of the episode, in a shocking twist, I think AJ is going to have enough of his dad, and he's going to kill Tony.
Wow.
That's what I'm going for. I don't know. Just to me, it seems like all that could culminate into something shocking like that. David Chase has built up this huge, you know, series, and like, you know, it's like a Greek tragedy almost, you know.
Yes, yeah. It is.
And for it to end something like that, something similar. I mean, I really want to go out. I mean, obviously, you invest so much time in The Sopranos. I mean, one of the beautiful things about the writing of that show is, like, you know, when something shocking happens, like when Silvio bumps off Adriana, you know, my wife is like, wow, I can't believe he did that, or, you know, she's like all shocked. Like, you have to remember, these guys are, you know, they're mafia.
Yeah.
They're evil.
Well, they're monsters.
They're
not good guys.
Yeah. Sometimes you need to be reminded by that, but then you realize just how good the writing is. But,
yeah, I think, you know, you bring up a good, just going back to Phil, Phil just hates Tony because he's never done time.
Yeah.
And I do want to see Tony and Phil go at it personally in some way, because that's, we only got 1 hour here.
That's true. I got to agree with John. I think he's going to whack Phil. I think somehow, you know, Phil might get to him. Who knows what's going to happen? Tony's obviously in a horrible place right now.
Oh, horrible.
They're not going to let the viewers Tony ruined like that without a tiny little bit of revenge.
Well, this is what David Chase has said. The only hint he's really dropped about the series finale is some people are going to love it, some people are going to hate it, but if you have followed the show from the very beginning, it is consistent with the texture of what the show is.
Oh, you know what? And with you saying that, I do have to leave you with this, and I'm glad you said that, because it is one thing I keep forgetting that I haven't told anybody.
Yeah.
You remember the ducks from the very first episode?
Yeah, it's got to end with the ducks.
Yes, thank you. It's got to end with the ducks. There's got to be, I don't care if Tony dies and he's dead on his property, the last shot should be something with ducks, and to that would be beautiful.
It would be
perfect.
Would be, I have no problem with that.
But he drained that pool last week, didn't he?
Well, I think that's going to be the point that
they
fly over and be like, what the hell?
Yeah, they'll be flying over and they can't let, oh, man, I can't wait.
And it's poetic in itself that his son tried to commit suicide in that pool.
Yes.
Exactly. We started the show here seeing the ducks, you know.
Yeah, David Chase is a genius writer, and you know what, he bucks convention, so if Tony doesn't die, it wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's what a lot of people are expecting. I think that's probably what Chase is banking on, and maybe, you know, again, I still think that he's going to die. I think AJ's going to kill him. I really believe that's what's going to happen, but if he doesn't, I won't be surprised either.
Right. Okay.
Can you tell us about your show tonight?
What do you guys have going on?
Well, tonight at 6 o'clock Central, right after you guys, we're doing our first improvisational off-the-cuff show. We have absolutely no topics. We're going to do our douche of the week like we usually do. We are, of course, going to have a couple of bits of commentary for our regular listeners who aren't able to catch your show. I'm probably going to throw out my Sopranos predictions again. But from that point on, we're going to take your calls, and we want people to call in. The whole point is to try to throw us off. What you want to do is call in with this phrase, which is, did you guys hear about, and then just throw anything randomly at us.
Okay.
So did you guys hear about the pony and the Mustang Cobra? And then we have to come up with something. Oh, yes, of course, that was in USA Today, and that was, you know, we'll just roll with that.
Okay.
We also have a segment called Ask Alex, where if you have any advice or you have any questions for Alex, throw that out. Just give us a call tonight at 646-915-9613. Even if you're nowhere near a computer to listen to the show live, take 2 minutes to call in and join in and listen later to see what our response was to you.
That'll be a great show.
All right, great.
Thanks so much for calling us, okay?
Yeah,
thanks a lot, man. www.thedeadairshow.com, guys. Have a great show.
You too. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Interesting theory. But In terms of favorite episodes, Chris, what would you say, you know, before last week, because last week blew us all away, what was your favorite episode?
Well, it would have to be, and it's a favorite among many people, I think, the end of, I think it was season four, the episode where Furio leaves, where he thinks about killing Tony. That season really focused on the family, and especially Tony and Carmella, and
that whole subplot. Yeah,
yeah. That the finale of that season was a really good one for me.
Yeah, it was probably the most surprising of all of the season finales.
I miss Furio.
Yeah, me too.
Oh, God, yeah.
Because it was a domestic fight. It was a breakup.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
You know, it wasn't who gets whacked. It was all of a sudden, it was a very intense, I was telling Jerry last night, it's like a Bergman film without all the boring. You know? It was like a dissolving marriage, and it was one of the most dramatic episodes of the entire show.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I would have to say that's, my personal favorite is actually from the first season, and it's the one that everyone talks about. It's the college episode.
Right, yeah.
Just a classic episode when Tony takes his daughter around to look for possible colleges for her to enroll in, and comes up with someone that's on the lam or something on the way,
right,
and has to kill him off. I guess it was an old snitch or something.
Right.
It's a great episode. Jerry, what about you?
Well, I think it's pretty obvious which episode I'm going to say, and it's, if you read a blog I wrote earlier last week, I'm going to go with the very first episode. I just, as soon as it starts, like within the first half hour, I felt at home.
Yeah.
I just felt at home. I know these characters in one way or another. They are very, remind me, Tony is no doubt a dead ringer for my father. And I mean that in every sense of the word. He is a dead ringer for my father.
See, you've told me that Larry David is.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Which one, Tony Soprano or Larry David?
Both. All right, let me tell you. My father's like a cross between Nikita Khrushchev, Tony Soprano, and Larry David. That's quite a fucking lethal combination. But he is in his mannerisms.
Right.
In his mannerisms, especially as a doctor, I have never seen anything quite like it. As Tony, he is very much in his mannerisms, his speech, like Tony. And my dad is near death while this show is coming on, but it was like, holy shit, that's my dad.
Right.
And I was like, what, was David Chase like spying on us for all this time? I mean, it was unbelievable. It was quite, but I just fell in love with the show immediately.
The show is like unimaginable without Gandolfini. I mean, I can't say that he's my favorite, obviously he is my favorite character, I suppose.
Yes, but as an actor before this, he only had a couple of roles where he was always played the heavy, no pun intended, but he was always like a thug.
He had that really powerful scene in True Romance.
Yes.
Where he beats the hell out of Patricia Arquette.
Yes, he does.
And I think that's what they used to call him in to audition for The Sopranos with.
Right. That's the exact scene. Because I think it was the other one is Carlito's Way. He has a bigger role in 8mm, not that that's something to write home about, but
right.
But he's always was playing the same type of roles, the thug, the henchman.
She's So Lovely, too, is another one where he's
yes.
very, very violent and very this menacing presence in that movie.
Yeah, so he's very excited about, you know, everyone else wants to do this, all the other actors want to do it until the day they die, but Gandolfini doesn't miss it.
So what, is he hoping that they're going to make The Mexican too? I mean,
no, his next project he's scheduled to play Ernest Hemingway.
Okay.
Which would be very good for him, I think.
I think it's fantastic casting.
Yeah,
it's fantastic
casting. He is very good, you know.
He would be, you'll forgive me, if I was him, I would have really not, I mean, he hasn't had the best of luck, with the exception, I think, of the Coen brothers from The Man Who Wasn't There, his small
he's
part
fantastic
there.
Fantastic in that movie.
I think he's very good in Last Castle. I mean, the movie, you know,
I don't.
Flaw, but I think he's very good. And it surprises you when you hear him speak in interviews. You know, Tony Soprano is a voice that he puts on.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, he doesn't sound like that.
No, he doesn't. But I think it was a role, I don't think I've seen, it was a role he was just, he fit immediately into it. It wasn't, it was like you bought him immediately.
Right.
And I'm kind of nervous about his eagerness to just abandon it completely, because this is the role. I mean, he will always, he can never escape this.
Right.
No.
Right. You know what? One of the things I like about Sopranos is that, and this was pointed out by a critic last week, I can't remember which one, but it shows that the violence, in the violence has a cost. You know, and just last week, whenever they did the hit on Silvio in the parking lot.
Yes.
And the motorcyclist was run over. You know,
yeah.
it showed that gang violence costs more lives than just those within the family.
Right.
It has a greater consequence. And that kind of brings us to our topic this week, because more and more we kind of see a barrage of violent video games and television shows during early evening hours and films that seem to show violence without consequence. You know, we've seen with Columbine and Virginia Tech and those kinds of situations that movies often become the fall guys for inspiring random acts of heinous violence.
Yes, they do.
Yeah, whether it's The Matrix or Old Boy or Natural Born Killers.
Or Taxi Driver.
Yeah, and Natural Born Killers is actually a film that was intended to be a satire on our supposed culture of violence. So our guest tonight can hopefully help us sort some of these out, some of these issues out. She has two master's degrees, and she's currently working on her Ph.D. She teaches psychology at several colleges in Florida, and she has invested a great deal of time and study in the field of media psychology. It is our pleasure to welcome to the show Ms. Angel Belden.
Hi, guys.
Hi,
hey, Angel. How you doing?
Great, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for being on the show. This is a very sensitive topic. And,
it can be, yes, definitely.
Yeah, it inspires passionate opinion. But what does, from your studies, what does the research say about the connection between violence and film and television and as it connects to antisocial behavior and those that watch it?
This is a great topic, and I think one of the most important things to remember is that this is one of the most studied topics in psychology. Media and its effect on our behavior is a highly studied topic, and it's a topic that's been around since the advent of media. And you know, in the 1960s, people predicted that there would be a television in every home in America. And of course, we now know that prediction has long since come true. And the new prediction is there'll be a television in every home in every room in America or around the world, really, before too long. And that, those predictions are starting to come true when you see television and appliances and in restrooms sort of thing. You really see that it has a pervasive effect on us. And so psychologists have been very interested in this topic for a very long time. And because it's one of the most important topics, we know several things pretty concretely. One is that short-term exposure to violent media can increase aggressive behavior immediately. So when we see short-term exposure, so you, there is a little bit of an increase immediately following the viewing. The second thing we know is that long-term exposure, particularly during childhood, can lead to an increase in aggressiveness throughout the lifespan.
Okay. I understand. You know, I understand both of the points you're making. You know, a clear example is that in terms of the short term, you're talking about people that see like Rocky in the theater, and they go out of Rocky and they feel all pumped up and you know, ready to fight and that kind of thing.
Absolutely, that's exactly what we're talking about. And you know, you have to remember what the point of media is. Why do you watch media? Why do you engage in this sort of form of entertainment? You want your emotional state or your cognitive state to be moved, to be changed.
Right.
You're desiring, you're seeking this media for something new, for something different. You're seeking this entertainment, and to entertain us, a lot of times this media will move our emotions. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it moves those emotions to action.
Exactly. Well, I mentioned those events like Columbine and Virginia Tech and many events before those too. They've been pointing the finger at certain films. Do you think it's more likely, though, that it's, you know, a heavy diet of 5 to 8 hours of television and video games that inspires this kind of violence than films, or is that unfair?
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the things that you have to look at is first of all, television is so much more pervasive than movies are. You know, how many movies do you watch a week versus how many hours of television do you watch a week? So television tends to be a lot more pervasive than movies, and even more of a culprit can be violent video games. And video games may be a little bit worse because of a few things that go along with video games in particular. First of all, a video game player must identify with the aggressor. You know, you are the aggressor, so you have to identify with that person in a very real way. Another thing is when you're playing a video game, you're a very active participant, particularly in first-person shooter games, where you are the person who's holding the weapon, who is then using the weapon against your enemies in the game. There's a lot of rehearsal. There's reward for aggressive sequences and violent behaviors. You get points or you win the game. And another thing about video games is the rate of violence in video games is much, much higher than the rate of violence even in a lot of most of our media, entertainment media like television and movies and that sort of thing. So the violence rates are much higher in video games than they are in the other things.
You know, it's just the times have changed so much. My favorite game is still Pac-Man. So, you know, that was such a different time.
Right.
But should we make a clear delineation here, though, between adult decisions, you know, adults saying that they're inspired by these movies as opposed to children that are brought up on them? Is there a difference there?
There's a huge difference here, Jamie. First of all, kids are not nearly as cognitively sophisticated as adults. They just don't have the cognitive capacity that adults do. This is what they're doing. They're growing up, they're learning, they're changing, their brains are growing and expanding, and they just don't have the sophistication that adults do. I mean, little kids, before they really understand the difference between reality and fiction, talk to the television, will try to reach to the television for things, will point to the television. And so they really don't understand the difference between reality and fiction at that age, very, very small children. And so if those small children are watching violent movies and violent television, they don't understand that it's fiction. They don't understand that it's entertainment. They don't get that. And there is a huge difference between adults and children. And what the research shows us is that the effects that we see are definitely present in children and much, much more muted in adults.
Right. Well, with me, I know that I saw my fair share of violent movies when I was very young. And I think I turned out to be a pretty sensitive, compassionate guy. So what is the missing link there?
What is that?
Why does it trigger something in others that it doesn't in some other people?
Good question. These are great questions. And there's certainly lots of research that points to different things, but there are more things going on. And certainly you mentioned Virginia Tech and Columbine and these sorts of things. I don't think we're ever going to be able to draw direct links like, you know, the shooter from Virginia Tech watched this movie over and over again and this movie inspired it. I don't think we're ever going to be able to draw direct links like that. But certainly there are also other factors. And most researchers, in fact, the top researchers in this field, namely Craig Anderson and one of his colleagues, Dr. Carnegie, they hypothesized this model of aggressive behavior. And in their model, not only goes the situational things or the media that they're consuming, that their individual participants are consuming, but also their affect, which is a fancy word for mood, their cognitions, their thoughts, and their states of arousal. So physiological arousal also plays a big part of it. And all of these things can be very complicated and are big factors, and they all need to be looked at, and it's not just any one thing that can be thrown there.
I know that we talked a couple of weeks ago about Bowling for Columbine. which is actually an examination of this issue, really. What can we learn from that film in terms of how mass media inspires this kind of behavior, or why the U.S. is considered a lot more of a violent culture as a result of mass media than any other culture?
I think Bowling for Columbine is such a great movie. I think Michael Moore did such a great job bringing up some very interesting questions and answering those questions for his viewers in a very particular way. And I think, you know, his take-home message is the big difference between the United States and other countries isn't the number of guns that we have. It isn't the number of people that we have. It isn't the number of, you know, violent situations that we have. One of the big differences is the fear-based messages that we have in our news media.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think this is so important. You know, people in news joke, you know, if it bleeds, it leads. But it's not really a joke. I mean, people, you know, in the news, they start with the most depressing, most scary, most horrifying images that they possibly can find on the news. This is how they start the news, and this is how they suck people into the news, and this is what the news media wants to portray. And we, you know, even as adults, we have this heavy diet of news media to keep up what's going on. And I think Michael Moore's point about that is very interesting and very well taken.
Yeah.
What do you guys think?
Our local news, especially like our Fox local news in the Washington D.C. area, I mean that's what it's like every night. It's like the most violent story, like a robbery or a car accident. It's like that every night here on the 10 o'clock news that we have on our Fox affiliate, probably more so than any other of the local news.
Yeah, and you know if Paris Hilton, you're right. If it's not some kind of heinous crime or bloodshed that leads, it's Paris Hilton, and I don't know which one is worse.
Paris Hilton
is considered substantial news nowadays.
It would be strange at this point, wouldn't it? Like to watch, you know, maybe NBC Nightly News, you know, and Brian Williams gets on there and leads with a, you know, an uplifting or enlightening intellectual kind of story. It would be very strange. I don't think we would know what to make of it.
That's true.
Yeah, we've been so accustomed to being fed that for so long.
I just can't even imagine that happening.
No, I couldn't either.
So what is the answer? Obviously, parenting. We're not talking about censorship here in any way.
Definitely not censorship. I mean, I can't emphasize enough. I love movies. I love video games. I love television. I joke with my students all the time when I watch TV. It's really like research. It's not for entertainment. I love those things, and I certainly love violent movies and action movies and those sorts of things. I think they're great, and I think for fully functioning cognitive adults, I think they're fine, and I think you can't have enough, you know, violence and that sort of thing for fully functioning cognitive adults. I think that is definitely definitely okay for adults as much as they want to consume that stuff. But for kids, we definitely need to watch out for them. I mean, kids just don't understand the differences. One of the things that you can do to help kids along is get them more media savvy. You can get them to participate in a media literacy program. You could do some scaffolding and some mentoring and some modeling and talk to them about violent television and violent movies and even the video games that they're playing and talk to them about how that stuff isn't real and that this isn't a way to solve your problems and even in the schoolyard, you know, getting them to use more verbal messages to get in touch with their emotions and being able to express those things. Certainly limiting the amount of television that kids watch would not be a bad thing.
Yeah.
And watching TV with your kids would also be a huge thing too. I mean, it sounds like such a silly thing, but watching television with your kids, answering questions that they have and talking to them about some of this stuff, parents can really serve as a buffer for their kids to watch some of that stuff. And Jamie, you had mentioned, you know, you certainly watched fair share of violent movies when you were a kid, and what's the difference? And one of those differences could have been your parents, that they maybe, you know, talk to you about that stuff, even if it was in a very casual way, not, you know, sit you down at the kitchen table sort of talk, but, you know, even if they did talk to you about this stuff in a casual way, and
yeah.
they said, you know, that stuff's not real, and that's not a way to do that. And if you're, even if you watched, you know, one or two movies a week that were violent, or two movies a summer, or four movies a summer that were heavy violent movies or heavy action movies, if you weren't, you know, back also watching at home a lot of violent television, then,
right.
you know, we wouldn't see some of that stuff. So certainly for kids, I would say limit and model.
Yeah, and you know, I think that watching 8 hours a day of TV is bad no matter what you're watching.
True, very true.
It makes you lazy, if nothing else.
Yeah.
I find, because I do watch 8 hours of television.
No, you don't.
No, I'm kidding. One of the things that I've always believed, and we'll close out on this, is that it's not so much that you're seeing violence, it's that you're seeing violence without consequence. You don't see the pain involved. You don't see the cost of it.
Right.
It's just random kind of mowing them down without forethought or afterthought or any kind of consequence. Do you think that is more damaging than actually being subjected to seeing violence?
This is a really interesting question, and I think this is a question that the research hasn't waded through as well as some of the other questions that has to do with, you know, certainly when we look at cartoon violence, because most cartoons are violent. When you look at kids' programming, if you watch the Cartoon Network at any given time, you see a lot of violence. Even the Roadrunner.
Oh, Roadrunner. You can't get more violent.
Yeah.
What happened to Wile E. Coyote every time, or the Roadrunner, every time they fell off a cliff? You know, they splatted, and there was a poof of smoke, and then in the next scene, the Roadrunner and the coyote were up again, and it was...
He had good health care. He had a good
yeah.
health care.
They had a very good health care system, which is the topic of my next film, right, health care. So we certainly know that in cartoon violence and this sort of thing, there are no real consequences. The problem with the consequences of violent television and movies and this sort of thing is that that viewing that sort of thing may lead to an increase in desensitization. And, of course, desensitization is the idea that you see so much of stuff that it's no big deal. You know, think about doctors or nurses in the emergency room. They see so much blood. They see so many fractures. They see so many, you know, lesions that to them it's not a big deal. You know, they don't freak out when they see that stuff in the ER, which is a good thing. We wouldn't want them to, you know, freak out every time they saw something gross or bloody. So it's a good thing that they can become a little bit more desensitized to that. And it would be a bad thing if the public at a whole became more desensitized to that sort of thing. But I think your point is really valid, Jamie. I think that not seeing some of the consequences is definitely a tough thing. You know, those home videos, those home wrestling videos that are so popular on the internet and that sort of thing, you know, the backyard wrestling videos.
Mm-hmm.
You guys know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do. There's a documentary made about that a couple of years ago.
Yeah, yeah. Those sorts of films and people, you know, doing those and remaking those and filming them themselves, you know, you're not seeing some of those consequences.
Right.
And that sort of thing, which can be pretty tough. And so I don't know. I think that that's definitely a muddy topic that even more variables go into that I think the research still has a long way to go about.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not suggesting that you make sure that the Roadrunner, like, you can see him in agonizing pain after every fall. I mean, it, you know, that's I know none of us are advocating that, but that's a little silly. But the ratio needs to be a little different. I mean, I remember when I saw Boys in the Hood years ago when it first opened, and very harrowing climax to that movie, where one of the characters that you really learn to have compassion for gets shot, and he suffers a slow, painful death.
Right.
And this is definitely a film that was promoting non-violence, you know, that violence is not the answer. And I think that was very valuable. It wasn't enjoyable. It probably didn't sell as many tickets as, you know, just a regular shoot 'em up. But I think that there needs to be more of that so people can appreciate that violence actually has a cost.
I agree. And the recent film, The History of Violence, that came out, I thought it did a great job showing some consequences of some violence. You know, when you saw somebody get shot in the head, you see the brain bits and the skull pieces go on people's shirts and in their faces and that sort of thing. And I watched it with a couple of friends, and one of my friends walked out of the film just completely disgusted. And he said, I would never watch that again. That was horrible for me. He couldn't
really
handle the guts and the disgustingness of it. You know, he likes an action movie just like the next guy. And I had just the opposite reaction to it. I was like, that was so great. I mean, it was hard to watch, and it was bloody and disgusting, but it was great that it showed some of these extra consequences of some of this violence that we don't typically see in movies, and I thought it was good because of that.
Right.
Absolutely.
Despite that.
Well, Angel, thanks so much for being on our show.
Thank you very much.
This is a big topic, and we're probably going to return to it sometime in the future because it's too much to just cover in 20 minutes, but
right.
we appreciate you being on very much.
Yes, thank
thanks
you.
For having me, guys, and I love your show.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hear that, we have a fan.
Yes, we do. We have the greatest fans out there. We have loyal listeners.
Absolutely. That's quite a topic, and we're very thankful to her to give us some insights onto the people that actually do research in this field.
Right.
Jerry, our guest critic is here. You want to tell us a little bit about him?
Yes, I do. He is probably, I have to say, Tony Farinella, otherwise known as the Bachelor Critic, is probably one of the most knowledgeable people on film, not only on MySpace, but on the Internet. He interviews a lot of people. Last week he interviewed Eli Roth, one of my heroes, that's for sure, regardless of what you may think about yesterday's misguided blog trying to explain my obsession with Mr. Roth. But this is a guy, I want to say right now, I never met anyone at that age, he's much younger than I am, but who has a great understanding of the classic old Hollywood films. And he is just always a pleasure to interact with. Ladies and gentlemen, Tony Farinella.
Hey guys, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. Nice to meet all of you.
Hey, likewise. Tony. This is a day that will be long remembered. I thought meeting Tony DeFrancisco was big, but this is bigger.
Well, I'm maybe number two next to him, but hey, I'll take it, you know? It's so nice to hear your voice finally, Jerry. It's so good to talk to you.
Likewise. This is a pleasure. This is a big pleasure for me. So.
And thanks for that great introduction you gave me, too. I'm very flattered.
I wish I could say more. It's hard for me sometimes to come off the cuff, you know? I was just this very serious conversation about violence, so you'll forgive me.
We're talking about violence now, because now we're going to bring up Hostel Part 2, which opened this Friday, to some mixed reviews and some mixed box office as well.
Yeah, tell
exactly.
us. Please.
What did you think of it?
Well, number one, I have a big complaint with Jerry's comment in his blog. He said that I think that Roth hates his characters, and I couldn't disagree more, because I think on the character in the film, whose name is Lorna, she's played by Heather, what's her last name? Heather Mazzarto.
Adam Osso.
I have no idea how to say her last name, but...
I haven't for like the last 10 years since Welcome to the Dollhouse.
Well, I think you said that he hates his weak characters, right?
I do believe that, but at least from what I can see. But no, please go on, please...
I wouldn't say he hates them. I just think he's showing what would really happen to them in this situation.
Okay, I'll give you that. No,
since to survive in these torture chambers, you got to be strong. And if someone like in the first film, Josh, who was played by Derek Richardson, he was weak, and that's what happened to him. And I think the strongest character, I have some spoilers here, so if you haven't seen the film yet, you know, kind of put it on mute for now.
If they don't see it by Thursday night, they ain't going to see it. They ain't going to be playing that much longer.
Right, but the only character that survives in the film is Beth. And she was the strongest, she was the smartest, and I think in the situations that Roth is portraying in this film, you have to be strong to survive them, I think, you know?
I think, you know, you bring up a very good point, and I wanted to add something to that. And,
sure.
I'm going to say this, I'm going to get in a lot of trouble, not from anybody except my mom for saying this.
Right.
But as one fellow Jewish boy to another, me and Eli Roth, I think he wanted to play on the whole victim scenario. And I think he likes to have the weak characters, he's going to say, yeah, this is what's going to happen to you. But the tougher characters, like Beth and Paxton, may he rest in peace. that's what upset me. If anything upset me, we'll get back to that. But he lets them turn the tables. And I think it is from this whole thing, from, if I will say, this whole playing the victim, being and he turns it, and he allows them to turn it, especially with the guy from the pharmacist from Desperate Housewives. Oh my God, he's never going to live this down.
I thought at first he was in the producers as the yay guy, and now he gets this happen to him. I mean, he's having some bad luck lately, isn't he?
Oh my God. So I think he's turning, he's using this whole thing. I think this whole thing is maybe himself probably, it's like kind of a reverse on how Spielberg got his revenge on the Nazis in his films, such as the Indiana Jones film and Schindler's List, and especially Saving Private Ryan. Roth has taken this and decided, I'm going to throw it in the Cuisinart, I'm going to do it my way.
Right.
And I think his villains, and especially, I think he likes Sasha the most for some reason. I think he, at one time, he might have been scared of Sasha, but he likes Sasha. He really identifies with him.
Tony, when you interviewed Eli Roth, did you do it by phone or in person?
Oh, yeah, by phone. I went to the screening on Thursday in downtown Chicago, and then on Friday morning he was doing phone interviews. And like I said, I mean, I'm not just saying this since I talked to him, but he was, you know, very professional, very nice. And, I mean, he's the best interview. I mean, as far as directors going, I'd say him and Tarantino and Rodriguez give the best, I'd say the best interviews, since they always have so much to say and they actually care about their projects. I mean, they've talked to, like, some of the actors, they're just kind of going through the motions, like, oh, yeah, it was fun, blah, blah, blah. But the directors, you can tell when through their voice that they really, really, really care about their work. And I think that shows in his films. You can tell he's a big horror fan because he's referencing so many other films. And I don't get why Roth gets flack when he mentions other films, but when Tarantino does it, everyone's like, oh, that was so cool. But for some reason, Roth, who I think is just like Tarantino, except in the horror genre, he gets branded and just torn apart for reasons that
I don't know either.
It boggles my mind.
Here's what I have to say. I think what everyone, and I failed to bring this out because my mind was elsewhere when it should have been on writing what I wanted to say, but I let everyone on a little secret right now. I never get out what I want to say. And it's maddening. But what I like about Roth is here is a guy who's just like us. And anyone who denies that, please just stop and put your pencils down. But he is just like us, and he has made it. I will say this now. I would kill to have his career. Okay? He has the dream career. I don't care what anyone says. This man is very lucky, and he deserves his success. It's a shame that it might be set back by this weekend's numbers, but he deserves his success. He's very lucky. I would, you know, anyone who says, "Oh, I don't want Quentin Tarantino presents in front of my movie," is a lunatic.
Right.
I want it very badly. But he's very lucky. But he's also, I like Hostel more than Part 2. Do I hate Part 2? No, I actually am quite fond of it. I think you'll have to, events happened as I got out of the movie, unfortunately, that the movie was put on the back burner, and because of that, God, I had to go see Surf's Up later in the day just to try to make up for it. But
Surf's Up, man. What were you thinking with that one, Jerry?
I like it better than the tap dancing one. Will Tony DeFrancisco like it? He'll crucify that movie.
he hates all dancing movies, I think.
He hates all penguins.
Chris, how's the one dancing film, the ballroom dancing film? What was that one called, where it shows the kids dancing at the ballroom downtown? What was that film called?
Oh, Mad Hat Ballroom?
Yeah, did he like that film, though, or no?
I liked it, but I think Tony probably threw a Molotov cocktail in the theater showing it.
Hey, Chris, did you get a chance to see Hostel this weekend?
Yeah, I went and saw it.
How'd you like it?
You know, I liked it. I just didn't think that it brought anything new to the genre like the first one did. It didn't up the stakes the way that the first movie upped the stakes for the slasher films. You guys are talking about how he has to have a character that turns it on its head. And that's true, you know, this character in Hostel 1 and in Hostel 2, there's a character that survives it. But, I mean, that's kind of true of all slasher movies, you know, whether you're talking about Nightmare on Elm Street, you know, at the end of it, Nancy, you know, she kind of turns the tables on Freddy, and that's kind of always the way it's happened. But the way Hostel, the first Hostel, just really upped the stakes as far as just making your gut twist and turn, and to the point where, and I never look away in movies, and I almost wanted to in the first Hostel because it was just so intense. And the second one doesn't not do that. It does the exact same thing. It just doesn't up the stakes the way the first one did.
Well, I mean, I think with the horror genre nowadays, though, is that there's so many films like Saw 3 and Wolf Creek that we've seen so many body parts removed and mutilated. I mean, what can be done, I mean, that we haven't seen before?
Well, it's funny you bring that up, Tony. In a piece on, there are two great pieces on horror films in the New York Times Arts and Leisure section today, and one of the articles, Eli Roth said, there are only so many ways you can skin a cat, but let me tell you, I'm working on so many new ways to skin a human.
Right.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, there's things we haven't seen. And, yeah, you can put in things in a movie that we haven't seen. And, you know, Tony, I agree with you. I think that the Hostel movies are definitely in a different category from the Saw movies.
Oh, definitely.
Oh, well, without a doubt.
I think there's a lot more. You know, Eli Roth brings, like, this intangible sense of joy to his movies. They're kind of fun. They're really fun. And they're meant to be laughed at, too. But at the same time, you know, this one just didn't up the stakes for me. He said the same question that you say, what can we do? And he answers, he says, we can cut a guy's dick off, you know.
And that's like in the Verhoeven movie, The Fourth Man, which is fine. I mean, I have no beef with that. I was surprised. Trust me, I think me and the four other members in the audience were shocked he went that way. But
that happens in a Verhoeven movie?
Well, The Fourth Man.
Why am I not surprised?
But, I mean, the bottom line is, if you like slasher films, if you're the kind of person that enjoys watching slasher films, it right now doesn't get a lot better than the Hostel movies. I don't care if it didn't make a lot of money.
Right.
Really entertaining, you know. I mean,
and there's so much fun because he has this, you know, adds, like, so much humor to it that you don't see in the Saw film. Because the first 15 minutes of the Saw film is just, is the Donnie Wahlberg character, he's the foot off, and then you go from him to the guy with the chains to Carrie getting her ribs removed. It's just like, relentless.
Tell me,
just
tell
like,
me, you're going to make me throw up.
Saw, to me, is like torture porn.
Yeah, it really is.
And I don't like the direction that horror movies are taking if they take that route, the Saw route. You know, and I think that what's going to happen is down the road, what was old will be new again. And they'll make a movie like, I don't know, one of the classic haunted ghost stories of the 60s. I don't know which one. But they'll get away from all this endless torture and gore and violence and really get to the core of what makes a horror movie exhilarating.
And it's boobs.
Well,
yes.
That's true. I have something to say. I think that Eli Roth is, I'm very excited, and I think his adapting the Stephen King book Cell.
Right.
Right.
Is very promising.
He's doing a trailer trash too, I think, right? He's doing like a whole series of trailers.
He wants to do that. Yeah.
Yeah. And you also have George Romero doing Tales from a Buick 8, another King book. So I think between those two and using Stephen King, who you really can't get much better than it. And a lot of his books in the movies suck. But I think Eli Roth doing a Stephen King novel, I welcome that. I think that has so much potential. I can't tell you. I think that has a lot of potential.
Yeah.
And worst comes to worst, we'll just send the bubblegum gang to our friend Jerry's house and have him throw rocks at him, you know?
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
So, Tony, would you recommend?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think it's one of the, I'd say the most fun times you could have at the theater this summer, you know, because the film knows how to make you laugh. I mean, the ending sequence with them playing soccer, I mean, come on, that's just priceless.
Well,
I
said it was a great commentary on why Americans don't get soccer.
Right.
And what more would you want from a movie? A commentary on soccer. Okay, so Hostel 2 would be your flick pick of the week, if not the summer.
Well, I mean, I think you have to know what you're getting into with these kind of films, because I mean, a lot of people just don't want to sit through this, and that's clearly understandable, because, I mean, it's not a film I'm sure I'd want to see again. I mean, I'll probably wait for it on, like, DVD, but, I mean, I think the first time is just such an adrenaline rush. I mean, the last 30 minutes of the film, he really goes into high gear, and there's so many twists and turns, and it really keeps you on your toes.
Okay.
That's one thing it does, yes.
We got 2 minutes. Jerry, what's your flick pick of the week?
I'm going to go with the series return this week on the FX channel, Rescue Me with Dennis Leary, one of my favorite shows after The Sopranos, and it doesn't get much better than that. And it comes on now Wednesdays at 10 o'clock on your FX channel.
FX. Chris, what about you?
I'm going to, in response to all this violent movie talk, I'm going to recommend a quiet, tranquil, interesting drama called Friends with Money by Nicole Holofcener.
Oh, okay.
And, it's a really, really touching movie about how we look at other people and how we judge people by how much money they have. It's a funny movie, and it's real sweet, too.
Is that the Jennifer Aniston?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, and she actually does a really great job, and it's the first time that I've taken note that she actually can be a very good actress. She's very charming.
Yeah.
And she looks very good in the maid's outfit in the film, too.
Listen to you. Mine is a complete 180 from the horror movies and the violent movies, too. It's called The Last Shot. It does have to do with gangsters. It's a comedy. Matthew Broderick, Alec Baldwin, and you know, anytime Alec Baldwin's in a comedy, you got to check it out.
Yeah.
And it's actually a true story, and it has a really cheesy box cover. You think it's going to be a really terrible B movie, but it's very, very funny, and it has great funny performances in it. And the last shot, look for it on your comedy aisle in your local Blockbuster. So that's my flick pick of the week. Guys, Tony, thanks so much for being
with
us.
Thank you, Tony.
Well, thank you, and I want to send my best to Jerry's family, too. You know, I hope Dad has a fast recovery.
Oh, no, he's fine. He's fine. I'll tell you later. It's fine. I appreciate it, Tony. You're a good man.
All right, take care, guys. Thank you again for having me. Really appreciate it.
No problem.
Thank you. Thank you, Tony. Anytime.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Guys, that's it for the show this week.
All right.
It went by too fast.
Yeah, it went by very fast. Sorry, thanks for everyone listening in this week.
2 hours until Sopranos. We'll talk about it next week, too. Okay.
Okay.
Bye, guys. Thanks
Bye-bye.
So much for listening.
Bye, guys.